Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope you're all doing great today and had a wonderful Sunday. Last night, we had quite an interesting conversation going on about involuntary outpatient commitment and people who are subject to it. And so we want to continue that conversation tonight and continue educating people about what it means to be subjected to involuntary outpatient commitment laws, and talk about some of those laws that are coming down the pike, including H.R. 3717, the Murphy Bill, the Helping Families in Mental Health Care Crisis Act, which includes provision for national mandates for involuntary outpatient commitment laws in every state. And then Kendra's law expansions in New York State, as well as things like Laura's law in California, for example. If you have a state that has an involuntary outpatient commitment law that you would like to bring attention to, or any other issue that you'd like to talk about, you can call in at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, and the toll-free line, if you need it, is area code 855-346-3351. That's area code 855-346-3351. I'd like to remind people about a couple of events that are coming up in the near future. June 26th from 8 to 10 p.m. on this show, on the Talk with Tenney show, there's going to be a conversation with Dr. Bonnie Burstow from Canada. I'm so excited about this. Dr. Burstow has worked over the years on exposing the abuse and torture of people, particularly women. What women have endured at the hands of psychiatry is just expansive and dates back decades. She's been an anti-psychiatry activist for around 35 years. Her work on exposing electroshock as a crime against humanity needs attention. And so the show on June 26th from 8 to 10 p.m., you'll be able to call in and discuss different aspects of Dr. Burstow's work, the fight against psychiatry. If you're interested in what's happening in academia and how people who speak out in academia are affected, what she calls the battle in academia, and strategic activism. Dr. Bonnie Burstow, from her bio, is a faculty member at Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at University of Toronto, and a very long-time anti-psychiatry activist, approximately 35 years. She is also a feminist therapist, a prison abolitionist, a left-wing anarchist, and a prolific author. Examples of organizations and events which she has chaired over the years include the Ontario Coalition Against Electroshock, Resistance Against Psychiatry, Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, and the first Psych Out Conference, which was absolutely amazing. Examples of her publications are Radical Feminist Therapy, Working in Context of Violence, Shrink Resistant, co-edited with Don White. And Don White, of course, has been a guest on the show and is an amazing activist. And then Dr. Burstow has also written Rose by Any Other Name, Naming the Battle Against Psychiatry and Mad Matters, and the much-anticipated, soon-to-be-released anthology, of which she is first editor, Psychiatry Disrupted, and that's with Brenda LaFrancois and Shangela Diamond and others, which is coming out through McGill Queen's University Press and promises to just be a phenomenal book. And so that's going to be June 26th from 8 to 10 p.m., and then on July 9th, we're going to be also having a special about judicial accountability and the jury trial, and I'm particularly excited about this. Our guests will include Aubrey Ellen Shomo and Katherine Hine. And it really is one of those issues that we need to look at, because the courts are so intimately involved in all of that's going on with people who are being, you know, court ordered into psychiatry. And so Catherine sent me a brief bio, and so her bio is that Katherine Hine is an advocate for the rights of psychiatric patients and is currently involved in the forced drugging involuntary confinement case of John Rohrer pending in the Ohio Supreme Court. She is an inactive attorney who does not practice law. From 1977 until 2009, she practiced law in Ohio and Oklahoma, representing battered women, parents of children abused by the other parent in custody cases, foster parents, citizens charged with petty crimes, citizen groups seeking to bring accountability to local government, and others. She had a solo practice representing clients in criminal, juvenile, municipal, trial, and appellate courts. She maintains a particular interest in federal and state constitutional law and how those principles can be used to combat the growing loss of freedoms Americans are suffering today. Katherine Hine has been involved with the Ross County Network for Children as a board member since 1996 and its executive director since 2005. In 1999, Hine authored the article Retaliation Against Professionals Who Report Child Abuse, a chapter in the anthology titled Expose, the Failure of Family Courts to Protect Children from Abuse and Custody Disputes. In 1994, she was a candidate for district court judge in a five-county race in the 15th Judicial District of Oklahoma. The same year, she organized the Oklahoma organization Stop Child Abuse Now. Her law degree is from the University of Toledo in 1976, and she has studied and taught in the Law School of Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. And this article, Retaliation Against Professionals Who Report Child Abuse, is really something that goes even deeper into another whole area of interest that I particularly have, of how people who speak out are silenced and retaliated against when they're trying to protect people who are, in the care of the power. On July 9th, from 9 to 11 p.m., Katherine Hine and Aubrey Ellen Shomo, and I will be getting a bio for Aubrey shortly, that they will discuss strategies to make the legal system more accountable, and they will cover the often overlooked right of jury trial in involuntary commitments. Aubrey will also talk about the fight in Colorado to preserve the jury trial. And then we'll look at judicial accountability and how citizens can resume their proper place as the conscience of the community. Also covered will be the behind-closed-doors style of juvenile justice that is making it all too easy for the government to lock up our young people, drug them, and stigmatize them as quote-unquote mentally ill when they are often just rebellious teenagers needing a little understanding. And so that promises on July 9th to be a really exciting show with a wealth of information from both Katherine Hine and Aubrey Ellen Shomo. And as more information comes out, I will be bringing you more information about that. July 3rd, I will be in St. Joseph, Missouri, at the Glore Psychiatric Museum. So if anybody lives around St. Joseph, Missouri and wants to meet me there, there is an event page on Facebook, and or you can contact me and we can arrange how to meet up. But the Glore Psychiatric Museum, I think, is something, if you don't know about it, it really preserves some of the horrors and abuses that have been perpetrated on people who have been psychiatrically assigned back to the 1800s, and was done in order to remind people about the kind of torture that people experienced. So I'm really interested in seeing what their new exhibits are and working with them about potentially creating some kind of exhibit on the history of the psychiatric survivor movement. So that's July 3rd. And then, of course, the upcoming organizing meeting at the Alliance on July 11th and 12th in Utica, New York, as a preliminary organizing meeting for the July 13th through 16th 72-hour vigil, which will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And we sit vigil for 72 hours. This will be the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil, where we speak out against psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit. And we do this for 72 hours because they can pick us up, detain, assess, and treat us for 72 hours in determining whether or not they will keep us for longer. And so we're trying to call attention to that and have that stop happening. And then July 24th through July 27th will be the Mind Freedom's Creative Revolution Conference in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And keynote speakers include Robert Whitaker, author of Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America, and a phenomenal journalist, medical, award-winning journalist, and Mary Ellen Copeland of the Wellness Recovery Action Planning. There'll also be focused work groups on hearing voices, coming off of psychiatric meds, open dialogue, peer respite, and Soteria House. And so that will be absolutely phenomenal. And then July 28th to 31st will be Youth Power University for people 18 to, I think, 30 years of age. They will be offering two courses, one on peer advocacy and the other on systems advocacy. And this will be held at St. Rose College, where people will live in the dorms and eat in the dorms and have a college experience and take these two courses, or one of these two tracks in the courses, peer advocacy or systems advocacy. And you can get information, more information there at Youth Power. So I think those are, and then there was a Twitter storm today, which I've got to apologize, I missed part of because, my sleep was just off, but I did wind up tweeting out and retweeting some of the mental HLTH Act for the civil rights mental health protest. The Twitter storm, they are using hashtags including we have a voice, stop forced psychiatric treatment, and if you can try to get onto Twitter and follow along and join into the Twitter storm around calling attention to the mental health civil rights protest, that would be great. And you can find their page on Facebook under the Mental Health Civil Rights Protest. If you'd like to call in and talk about involuntary outpatient commitment or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. And so, yeah, it's been one of those days of where, people are trying to speak out, trying to organize, trying to have their rights protected, and at the same time, the government is going full speed ahead in limiting our opportunities for freedom and for being able to, live without being subjected to psychiatry. When you put out issues like Eve Filatori, who is absolutely pushing the idea of reinstitutionalizing people. I don't even think he really wants involuntary outpatient commitment. I think he wants everybody in institutions again. You know, prettier, nicer institutions than the ones of the 19th century. But I think that it is, you know, it's one of those issues. And on the when he was on the Diane Rehm show about a month ago, you know, Diane Rehm asked him, but I'm reading from the transcript here, but how do you know if someone is potentially dangerous? And Tori said, well, I think that they demonstrate. I mean, you should be able to, you should not be able to use this kind of treatment until a person has demonstrated some kind of dangerousness or threatened people on it. And I think we have the ability to do that. And then Rehm says, Dr. Eve Villatori, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm show, what about that Curtis Decker? How do you define the individual who may be harmful to him or herself in the community? And then Decker says, well, that's exactly the issue, Diane. You can't. It's a continuum. And so there is no, you know, nobody holds him accountable for the lack of information that he actually gives people. And then when, you know, somebody is asked otherwise, it's disputed and then gone on right along as if this is legitimate. And it's not legitimate. Line 202, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, this is Yvonne Smith. One of the things that you have to look at, Tori is the executive director of TAC. And if you go to their website, you'll see who their board of directors are. And I can't remember the gentleman's name. I'll try to look it up while I'm online. But the head of the Sheriff's Association of the United States is also on his board. And you look at them to understand how they're influenced. You know, the reason why, I agree with you. They really want to go for reinstitutionalization. The only problem with that is that when you say you want to lock people up, they have mental health issues, you got to have brick and mortar places. And a lot of hospitals now have kind of tapped themselves down. So the only place for people to be is in jail. So they just want to have another way of keeping people for longer, longer times. Many people may have heard on the news that the Justice Department is offering clemency to people who have nonviolent crimes, where there was a difference in sentencing because of sentencing laws, you know, mainly around things such as someone using drugs or the way that they are allowed. And I truly believe that that's what they want to do. They want to make sure that people stay for a long length of time, because you and I know that even if it's a not guilty by reason of insanity, I know that everyone who would be held in the AOT would not have anything to do with criminal acts. But if you take a person, you clone them and split them in half, and let's say they have whatever crime it is, whether it's minor or major crime, one person goes to prison, the other person goes to psych hospital. And in many cases, what happens is the person who goes to psych hospital is there for a long enough time. And no one challenges Tory on it. No one challenges on, I know even some of my peers don't like me saying that, well, you know, you have to have brick and mortar places. And what they want to do is to bring in the psychiatrists and psychiatrists in the institutions, which are the prisons, so they can keep people for a longer length of time.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think that they're even going back, even in the new involuntary outpatient commitment laws that they're trying to pass in New York, that did pass in the Senate and that has been referred to Assembly mental hygiene, that they can go back in time anything prior to when your sentence or time in the institution or incarceration actually began. So the idea of extending this further out over time, that this is a real issue. Are you talking about Thomas Faust? He's a emeritus board member of TAC, and he's the former executive director of the National Sheriffs Association.
Probably. I'm trying to look it up now. Probably.
Yeah.
We have a lot of people along for. Oh, James Koppel. Is that who you said? Is that the name you gave?
No, I said Thomas Faust. James Koppel? Okay.
James Koppel is, he's a National Crime Prevention Council. He's on there also. But they did have a sheriff on there. I'm trying to figure out the name because I remember on another occasion Tory saying that this particular sheriff had given some of his money for his county to the mental health because he didn't want the mentally ill people in his jail. And there's a difference between jail and penitentiary. A lot of times jail people go in for less than a year. If you're in, a medium-sized city, but in large counties, it's not unusual for someone to be held for some place for less than a year. In a place that would be a jail where there would be a waiting trial or you're sentenced for petty crimes. And petty crimes means maybe what some people call crimes of emotional distress, like a person not doing well, maybe they peed on the street, and that's the way that somebody feels they can get them into custody or they ate out a salad bowl or something like that. Yeah. But they had several people from law enforcement on their board, and I didn't know. But you're talking Thomas Faust, National Sheriff's Association, right. Yes, I'm referring to him. Yeah. So they have that law enforcement edge, and then you have to go back and understand how law enforcement and the sports treatment got together. Like a lot of things maybe started out as being what some people think is a good thing. Like, some people think AOT is a good thing. We know it's not because, as the other gentleman there on the Diane Reed show, it's a slippery slope. Some people would have thought that having police involved with people who are in emotional distress because police officers are the ones who call, that would be a good thing, but it was a slippery slope, and as you pointed out to us for the guy in Texas and other places around the country, that when the police are called, they're used to dealing with bad people and not necessarily people who might be confused, maybe not necessarily dangerous.
Well, not even bad people, but people who may be doing something criminal. I think that criminal, again, is really, under dispute right now in the United States as what is or isn't criminal, is coming under question. But I do want to point people to on TAC, on the Treatment Advocacy Center's page. They have a tab just on H.R. 3717, the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act. And I think that, as we're continuing to fight against this bill, to look at what it is that TAC promotes of the bill, and what they promote of it is that it will empower parents and caregivers by wiping out protection and privacy protections and increasing the ability to get people locked up. It will address the shortage of psychiatric beds by adding more money into psychiatric institutions. Stabilize patients beyond the emergency room, which means, right into the institution. Promote alternatives to institutionalization. I'm not sure exactly what that is, since the H.R. 3717 cuts out all of the alternative funding. Encourage greater use of criminal diversion programs, and so then you got more people winding up coming into getting psychiatrized for petty crimes or for, like, trespassing because they needed someplace to sleep or something like that. reach underserved and rural populations. So if you're a person of color or if you're living in poverty or you're living in an environment that doesn't have a lot of psychiatry, watch out. Foster evidence-based care, and the only evidence that they've got is that the stuff causes damage. Advanced critical medical research.
Backstroke a little bit to analyze this because, like I said, you and May and maybe some other people are intimately acquainted with this. I want to ask you a question so you can elaborate. You said that H.R. 3717 takes away money for other services. Can you elaborate? Because a lot of times people don't understand that, you know, exactly what this is doing. You said it's taking away money for other services. I think you're talking about the block grant, right?
Well, it requires states to authorize and create assisted outpatient treatment laws in order to receive community health service block grant funds, and that's right on the tax webpage. But it also would eliminate all of the alternatives funding. And so the strike against the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, including things like the minority fellowships and the alternatives conference and any of that. And then it also slashes funding for protection and advocacy organizations. I'm just reading right off the tax page. It says prevents federally funded protection advocacy organizations from engaging in lobbying activities and counseling individuals on, quote, refusing medical treatment or acting against the wishes of a caregiver. And so this really, what's the alternative? The alternative is that you shut up and comply. There's an agenda to go after young people and to, reduce the quote-unquote stigma, like this is what creates it in schools. And then the integration of primary and behavioral care, which everybody needs to be really concerned about as far as I'm concerned, because this is where they get us and this is where the electronic medical records become very dangerous. And it says an increase in physician volunteerism in community mental health facilities and a reform of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And so it's under that SAMHSA that all of the alternatives would really get seriously cut, including things
and,
like the Alternatives Conference.
Yeah, I think that people should. You're right to point that out. They should go to TAC and look at 3717. And also, it's specifically, even they're going after those five states. There are five states that don't have ALT, that don't want it. Those five states are Tennessee, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Mexico, and Connecticut. So they've gone after these five states. It says the Helping Families and Mental Health Act requires the five states that don't have laws authorizing the practice of ALT as a passing in order to remain eligible for certain federal block grant money. And there are other block grant monies other than the mental health block grant. There's many block grant funds, and a lot of states rely on that money. There is no additional money in 3717, as you said. Wiping that out, and it's wiping out the protection and advocacy program. And the idea behind that is that they think somehow that the protection that TAC people feel, or the protection and advocacy people, are preventing them from forcing people into to treatment. And there's no way to force people into treatment. Well, there is a way to force people into treatment. You force people into treatment, but there's no additional funds for anything. Only thing that they're going to do is create a bottleneck, and we know what what ultimately what happened is when they increase a bottleneck because people are, they can mandate people give you treatment all they want, but what happens when they can't see the doctor to get that treatment that they're talking about?
Right, or what happens more commonly and what people are calling into this show all the time talking about is when they go to see the doctor that their physical complaints are overlooked and disregarded and that they can't even have somebody talk about what's going on physically until they get through a psychiatric evaluation. And that real fear that people have about having their physical health mixed up with their with anything psychiatric or behavioral or drug or alcohol related. This is going. I don't think that people realize how damaging this combination of this mental health and physical health thing is going to be. But every time somebody calls in concerned about going to a physical doctor, it just breaks my heart because this is one of the reasons why we're dying 25 to 30 years sooner. I mean, on top of the drugs, that our actual medical conditions are ignored or brushed off then as psychiatric. And I think it's this is to head off a really big problem. I'm not sure how to do it, but this is part of what's going to happen as soon as, the more that they integrate this and then the medical records, like you've talked about before, going electronic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all right there. That's the first thing people see is whether or not you have a psychiatric history. And that alters the way people wind up
that prevents the doctors from asking the critical questions and doing the right kind of examination that uncovers, as you said last night when people were on, they talked about how they actually had real physical issues and they were life-threatening, and the doctor wasn't paying attention to it because of the medications they were on or the fact that they were listed in paperwork as being a client of the local mental health clinic. But one thing also, if you look at this thing, everybody should really look at TAC's website really carefully. I didn't even realize, I want to get back to the 3717, but I want to say this out so I forget. I recognize that Aoife Otori's wife is the treasurer of this organization. His wife is the treasurer.
Oh, that's interesting.
His wife is the treasurer. I thought you had to look at the people. I learned this from looking at organizations. You look at who the board of directors are, the relationships that the people that are on the board of directors that they have with other institutions and why they're doing it. Even it mentions in this about the little talking test about 3717, they talk about, jail diversion and CIT. And for people that may be new to the show, a jail diversion is wherein they can bring you for what they call a mental health court. And this is probably the vehicle they're going to use to force people, these forced interventions. And I just can't imagine that in some jurisdictions where you've got a crime going on, where you're going to divert the court docket from going ahead and dealing with serious criminals to force someone into some forced intervention that, they're going to waste county resources to do that. And in most cases, when a person is doing this, they'll have to have a public defender that's paid for by the county or the state. That'll be even more money diverted from there. It says HR 3717 promotes use of jail diversion programs such as mental health courts and crisis intervention teams, policing. Now, in many places, money is already short for sheriffs and police. So you're going to divert people from going after the guy who robbed your house or robbed your business or whatever, and they're going to be diverted for these
right.
things, criminalizing people. So you know when the police come, they're not going to be happy about it. Because they're not going
to
get
credit.
Well, I mean,
the other thing that people really need to be aware of mental health courts is that generally when you've done your time in the criminal system, your time is over. But when you go in through one of these agreed backroom deals that are made in a mental health court, you may wind up spending the rest of your life involved with psychiatric involvement. They may never let you out entirely. And so... when people are offered the idea, generally people say just go through and do your time for whatever crime you were committed and don't go through the mental health alley because that will leave you in a uncertain amount of time that you'll have because then you never know when your time is done. And at least in criminal court, your time is done when your time is done. I do want to give out the number if anybody wants to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, and the toll-free line, if you need it, is area code 855-346-3351. It's 855-346-3351. This thing about Barbara Boyle Torrey, though, being the... I never knew that before. That's interesting.
That's why you have to do this. It's just like the same thing. All this, a lot of stuff is public information. The same thing. I haven't been able to sign anything on mental health policy.
Are you sure it's his wife? Are you sure it's his wife? Because it refers to her as Ms. Torrey, not Mrs. Torrey.
Ms. is MS?
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Torrey is a name that the people use. I'm old enough, the women's liberation movement, where we didn't want to be designated Mrs. or Miss. It was Ms. And Barbara Boyle Torrey, National Academy of Sciences, retired. That would make her the same age. And I was told this by someone else, too, because she, the National Academy of Sciences is in Washington, D.C., right across from the State Department, they write some papers for Congress, actually. I'm going to Google her right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be, I just don't want to put out the...
false information.
Yeah, who raised two children with his wife, retired economist Barbara Boyle. Yeah, no, they're married.
It's her.
Yeah.
I was told this. About a good authority of someone who worked with her. This is, but you have to look at the close relationships that these people have.
Right, but Torrey is on the board too. I mean, Torrey isn't getting any financial. He doesn't work for TAC. Right. I mean,
they gave him because he is the. He is the executive director, and you have to look at the 990.
Well, he's the executive director of the Stanley Medical Research Institute, not of the Treatment Advocacy Center.
And did you know the Stanley Medical Research Institute provides over half the money for research on bipolar and schizophrenia in this country?
Yeah, and cuts up brains and stuff.
So
I mean, I think following the money is important and that we need to be doing that. But, I think also just to make clear that it is a separate thing. Although I wonder if you looked at the board of directors between Stanley Medical Research Institute and TAC, what kind of overlap there might be.
Stanley is on the TAC. So he's the... son of the, I guess, the original entrepreneur for the Stanley Tools, which was the foundation itself. I wish that I have been asking some other people who know some of these principals to come on the show, but I don't know if they're listening or they're just waiting to come on or whatever. But, there's a lot of insights to why, and the chief of police of New Windsor, New York is on there. So this is a lot of law enforcement on here. But, you know, that sometimes helps you understand different people's perspective. It may not necessarily be their motivation, but it's to understand and understanding how boards work. Because someone could be the president or the executive director or something, but usually the board has oversight, and people that are on a board of a, if it's a nonprofit, usually people who come with their money to have a lot of say so about what.
Right. I mean, and he's, you know, Fulatory is the founder of the Treatment Advocacy Center, but he doesn't, and he's on the board, but to the best of my knowledge, he doesn't actually draw any money from it, but that it's used as a way to push out an agenda. I mean, the Treatment Advocacy Center has a clear-cut agenda for, you know, creating involuntary outpatient and involuntary inpatient. I mean, I think that's just involuntary treatment. They support it, and they think that it's necessary, and they think that parents and family members should have more rights than the people who are involved with the actual system. And, you know, this page that they have on their website that I try to call attention to people, they, you know, it's called reinstitutionalization. And so this is where they're fighting the idea that after 50 years of deinstitutionalization, quote, it seems we're still housing people with severe mental illnesses in institutions, and they're pushing this fraud that, you know, that it's because people are winding up in jail or prison, and that's just, you know, if we accept that as the argument, then we're letting them win. That what
that's
needs to happen.
They're heavy on law enforcement. That's what it is. They're heavy on, their board is heavy on law enforcement. And they have a couple of people that have ties to large family organizations that were formerly from the old days. I think some of these family organizations, there are two of them. They actually are changing. They're moving away from, you know, force or whatever else. But still they have, their grassroots are a lot of times parents who are in their 60s and 70s and they have older children. Some people actually do believe that, I don't think, they don't espouse it, but they believe that what they call mental illness is put the person in a suspended state of extended adolescence, where they should not have the right, you know, in most places when you're 18 years of age, then you have the right to make decisions for yourself. And I saw this when I was involved in my local mommy and served on my local mommy board, is that you'd have people that were 40-some years old who did not, some of them do live with their parents, but did not live with their parents. In fact, some people did not even live in the same city, but they felt it was their responsibility to intervene when it came to their children. And these are children that are, you know, old enough to have children themselves or grandchildren.
So. These are adult children.
Yeah, like I said, 40
these are adults.
Adults.
They're adults. And so that's another whole thing that gets very easily messed up here when people don't realize, who may not know about any of this, who don't, they're talking about adults who have been psychiatrically labeled, whose parents are trying to get them into psychiatric treatment, and like things that H.R. 3717 do is crimp the privacy laws, so that it's in favor of parents being able to find out about medical issues of their adult children, And so,
and many of the people, at least that I had the parents that came down, local, the adult children were already in the mental health system. They just wanted to be able to, you know, get information and to direct their care. So, you know, sometimes people are already, they're already in the mental health, public mental health system. They just want to be able to, I call it meddling, but they just want to be able to get information and direct. And that's wrong. Once you're 18, 21, I feel like you're outside your parents' home. Even if you're not outside, you're over 18 years of age. If you don't like what a person is doing, I know it's going to be harsh and long. You might not even like me saying this. But if you've got an adult, a person living with you, and you've got rules and regulations, and they don't want to follow them, then they can leave. And that's what some people do. They leave. They leave their parents' home. And the parents then want to say, well, you know, they're homeless. Or oftentimes, I have this today. I know parents who have adult children in the hospital. And they're saying, well, they're, I said, they're still there. When is someone still getting out? I said, when are you going to take them? Oh, they're not coming home with me. But they want to be able to direct. I don't know. It's some kind of, I don't know, phenomenon they're having where they still feel they've got to extend themselves over people that are, you know, 20, 30 years past the age of majority. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a real meddling problem. And you know, the privacy, with the limited privacy rights that we currently have, H.R. 3717, further just wipes away at any kind of privacy, that, and the idea that parents can, you know, get access to your medical records, and they can be the ones that are determining whether or not you need to be seen on an involuntary basis. And when there's so many issues of, like, differences in living, you know, lifestyle, values, money, economics, like, these are the things that people are winding up fighting about. And so if somebody isn't, you know, playing along inside of the family's social values,
if adults who's 40, who's over, he's only, say, what, 25, 30, 40 years old, can all of a sudden have someone else, he just has to have a biological tie and do that. At the same time, you can have a neighbor. You know, under assisted outpatient treatment, you could have a neighbor or police officer make a complaint about you. If they know about your psychiatric history, or suggest, you could be in danger. So that's why some people say, well, why should I be concerned about this? Because this is not going to hardly affect, this is hardly not going to affect anyone. I said, and it's probably, I said, not. They're just going to break it up. They've said that what they want to do is that they want to go after, they found that some of the parts like the TAMI are very, people not swallowing going down, so they'd rather break off pieces like the AOT or like the, which I know, Lauren, you're very concerned about, is the screening, to break that off in little pieces.
Well, I think the screening obviously is a major issue for everybody, and that's, but I think that the H.R. 3717, the wiping out of PAMI, for example, the idea that that somebody can't, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the right words here, but that somebody can't, that PAMI can't advocate for people to, quote, to counsel individuals on, quote, refusing medical treatment or acting against wishes of a caregiver. I mean, what else is protection and advocacy there for if not to assist somebody who is being tortured and abused? And why wouldn't they be able to give insight to somebody who is trying to refuse medical treatment?
They could cause them great harm. what they do is they lie. See, part of the bill is finally they put forth these false premises. Number one false premise is that the PNAs lobby with federal funds. That's a lie. They don't lobby with federal funds. Most of them are 501c3s, and they could be have their 501c3 status. Some of them are not, a few, but most of them are 501c3s. Their status could be taken away with them because they're, and they cannot use, and the contracts that they have, the PNAs with the federal government says they can't use the money for lobbying. Now, that does not mean that they can't raise money from elsewhere to educate legislators. They also, the lie that they say is that the PNAs initiate contact to, they act as a barrier for treatment, as if the PNAs, that's what they're about, is to keep people from having, getting treatment. The PNAs largely protect people who are in institutions, and in each PNA, because I used to be on an advisory council for my local PNA, every year the PNA council, which are made up of people with lived experience and family members, they decide what kinds of things the local PNA will do. And they don't have, they have a nice little piece of money. They do not have lots of money to do a lot of things. And they're there when people call and initiate and they ask for. They do not go up to people
right,
who have mental health.
I'm right there with you. But you know, I'm looking at this thing and it says that unauthorized activities, including counseling patients in crisis to refuse treatment against their physician's advice and caregiver's wishes, and so preventing treatment was not the intent of PAMI, and so but the protection and advocacy is, and if somebody is wanting to refuse psychiatric intervention, which they see as harmful, that is protection.
It is, but they don't initiate. The person contacts the PNA saying, look, they're trying to force me to take this and I don't want to do it. Can you help me? They don't initiate it themselves.
No, frankly, to get any PNA to pay any attention to anybody, because they're also overwhelmed with rights violations, claims. I mean, you know what I mean, of people calling with charges of human rights violations, that who would have the time to really sit down and create an organized effort to get people to refuse treatment? This is the scam that Murphy and all of them are pulling, the idea that protection and advocacy is doing something other than what it was charged to do, which is protect people and advocate upon their behalf. But the idea that caregivers get thrown in there, that it's not only against the wishes of the psychiatric, you know, place, but it's also against their physician's advice and caregiver's wishes. So why the hell do all of a sudden caregivers get some kind of extended privilege underneath H.R. 3717, along with this privacy issue? I'm just looking under frequently asked questions, and it says, what are the changes to HIPAA, and how will they affect patient privacy? And it says H.R. 3717 clarifies existing sections of the HIPAA privacy rule and clarifies those sections in a statute to assure that doctors and caregivers can communicate during a mental health crisis. Currently, providers frequently misinterpret or overinterpret the guidelines, which restricts participation by family members and impairs the ability to act in the best interest of patients or psychiatric crisis. This classification... Let me finish what it says. This classification enables caregivers to receive protected health information when a mental health care provider reasonably believes disclosure is necessary to protect the health, safety, or welfare of the patient or the safety of another. The definition of caregiver includes immediate family members. And so this is, this is a direct violation of people's privacy. You're involved in some kind of psychiatric something. You don't want to do what it is the provider wants you to do, and now they're going to call your mommy or daddy.
Well, the reason why they're doing that is because people do have another route if they want to be involved like that. There's guardianship or conservatorship. The only thing that, for the people that I call them, the meddlers, the only thing that happens is that what they say is if you're a guardian of somebody, you have to take their wishes into account. So if you're the guardian, let's say that you're my mother and you went to court, you became my guardian, and you decided that I should be in a group home. I said I don't want to. Well, guardianship doesn't says that you are supposed to take my wishes into account and to doing that. And I can fight if you decide to place me in a group home, even though you have the right to place me wherever I want to. Because I can say you disregarded my wishes and that I had capacity to live on my own with support. And so that's the thing, is that the assisted outpatient treatment trumps all that. So people that really feel as though their son or daughter or husband or wife can make good judgments, they always could go to court and have the person, have them become the guardian of the person. But there's a higher standard when you want to become a person's guardian, and also once you become the guardian, you're supposed to take the person's wishes into account. So this is, I believe, the reason why that they're having that is because they want to trump all of that. They want to have a fast track. The gentleman last night, he described very, very well what happens when people go into a mental health court. You know, basically, things, not in all cases, but they've already been decided. The judge and the psychiatrist and other people involved, they are chummy because they're involved each day with each other. And so, and you may not be able to have other people in there to support you. You're there by yourself. I mean, it's not quite as bad as a treatment team meeting, but pretty much they're saying, you know, you can do this. Oh, there's other consequences. And in a case with assisted outpatient treatment, there won't be any consequence, because it's not like someone is saying you committed a petty crime or even a major crime and you have a choice of either taking going to the big state. You have a choice of having assisted outpatient treatment or either going and doing your time, so you won't have that. Because, as I said, guardianship, there is a higher degree of responsibility on the guardian to abide by the wishes of the person. So if you had a person as a guardian, they didn't want to take medication or go to a particular day treatment, they wanted to do something else, and the judge who would periodically oversee, they wouldn't care that you thought the person should go and get this treatment. They wouldn't, the issues of whether or how the person's functionality would even come into it. It would come into the fact that...
Yeah, and that's where, like, just the fraud is, again, because, like, there's something that psychiatry can offer outside of, you know, like...
But I'm just saying you need to pay attention to guardianship, too. This is happening in Florida. There was another show on blog radio just before this one, and they're talking about what's happening with senior citizens there. So there is this real rush to, as this woman has said, to enslave disabled and also the elderly. Because this will happen to people who are in nursing homes and things like that. There's a real push to it. And they always attack the people who are weak, and they are ready customers for a healthcare system.
Right, and they're just waiting, and so then in guardianship you lose all rights as your autonomy and your ability to...
as well. They can have control property. I have a friend there. They're going to court in August or something. This person was very active in the consumer movement locally, and They want the agency is penalizing her. She's being hurt because she was a person who was put on the ACT team, and she thought that she should have the services, so she demanded the services. They didn't want to give it to her. She went into crisis. She presented herself because she was having some bad reactions to medication. She's an older person. She presented herself to the hospital because she wanted care, because she knew she was having this interaction, and the agency didn't respond. And she kept, you know, reporting herself to private hospitals. I'm a very big believer in that. Don't use the public system unless you have to. And they want to punish her for it, you know, for acting. They dumped her off when she got out of the state hospital. They dumped her off at a place, didn't come to see her for 2 weeks. If I wasn't there, she didn't have a sheet or anything. They dumped her off at a Y with not even sheet, pot, pan, or anything.
Yeah. It really is. It really is just horrifying. And if you're listening out there and you'd like to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. If you want to call in, if you need a toll-free line, we have a limited amount of time on that. It's area code 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. I am going to open up area code 865's line just in case we've been having technical problems and I just want to make sure you're not holding and you want to be talking. So 865, your line is open if you're interested in talking. Okay, I'm going to guess that you're going to continue to hold. And if you, again, if anybody's online, there are a couple of people online who just hit one if you want to talk. Again, the number to call is 267-521-0167. And so I don't think that people realize the lack of or the amount of control that one's life becomes under when they're involved with a court-ordered process, that every desire that you have for your life, every dream, every goal, anything that you want to do has to get meted out through psychiatrists and judges and lawyers, where you're constantly being told that you can't accomplish the goals that you want or that they're not legitimate. And I think that that's a really big problem.
And also they're being kind of prompted because even though we know that there's risk. As risk, they become risk averse, wherein they were either on the side of protecting their own reputation. Just because you prescribe somebody to take medication does not mean they're going to take it. I mean, you know, unless you give it to them in a shot.
Well, and that they're doing. I mean, or like that person who called from Wyoming a couple of weeks back with medication prompters that people come up and show up at your door and you have to take the drug in front of them in order to be able to live in the community. And so they have all kinds of ways, but the injectables, I mean, you know, a definite month. You know, a shot that lasts for a month, and if you don't show up for your shot, then you're committed. These are real concerns that I think that from a civil liberties perspective, the average person who has nothing to do with psychiatry should be very concerned about and speaking out about.
In states like Tennessee, I was talking to Larry Drain in Tennessee, and he was saying they don't have the brick-and-mortar places anymore, you know, to put people. Tennessee does not have assisted outpatient treatment. They have a robust peer network. We know that this is these things that they're trying to put through, but there are things that are working.
They do have emergency detention. Because I'm looking at TAC's website, and TAC lays out all of the involuntary ways in which that you can get somebody involuntarily admitted. And so it's a if and only if and then if and only if and then. So it's probably not it's not stringent like that. You know what I mean? Like to the degree. So emergency detention in Tennessee is if and only if, one, a person has a mental illness or a serious emotional disturbance, and two, the person possesses an immediate substantial likelihood of serious harm under Section 336501 because of the mental health illness or serious emotional disturbance, then the person may be detained to obtain examination for certification of need for care and treatment. And the admission to the treatment facility is if and only if a person has a mental illness or serious emotional disturbance and the person is an immediate substantial likelihood of serious harm because of the serious mental illness or emotional disturbance, and the person needs care, training, or treatment, and all available less drastic alternatives to placement in a hospital or treatment resource are unsuitable to meet the needs of the person, then the person may be admitted and detained. So, I mean, it's
seems like they've made it so that you really gotta be you know, pretty desperate character. Like, you know, you have your manifesto put on YouTube that you're going to blow people away and stuff, which people have done. You know, I think it's a good thing that they err on that side. And evidently, it's working for them. I mean, because they haven't been able to pass, they don't want assisted outpatient treatment. They have what they feel as though is a stringent enough commitment law. I mean, you know, really what you're saying is if a person is not able to make those decisions, but you want to have them in the community but forcing them, I mean, that's going to have all kinds of anger issues.
See, I don't see this as legitimate. I don't see that having a psychiatric history is a grounds for being involuntarily treated, and I certainly don't see the idea that psychiatric history can create an immediate substantial likelihood of serious harm. I mean, it's the danger to self or other cause. That's all it is. And I feel like that's something that we fight against as legitimate. That's not legitimate. And danger to others, obviously, if you're about to commit a crime or you're committing a crime, that's one thing. That's criminal. But danger to self is a subjective kind of thing, and I just don't see it as legitimate for grounds for psychiatric detainment.
Well, that's another battle, but, you know, that's not 3717. All I'm just saying is that the states that they're pinpointing, and most states have some kind of inpatient commitment law, even though we may not like it, you know, that it's, well, you have to actually lie or whatever else to say to get a person committed. I mean, this is the same thing that they were saying about Deed's son, you know. It wasn't necessarily that they didn't have a...
I'm sorry, saying about what?
Deed's son in Virginia, you know.
Okay, right.
In other words, or the child in Virginia, the guy who had that, they, you know, in other words, they didn't see any imminent reason why he would be locked up. So I'm just saying that, you know, as much as I would disagree with anybody being forcibly put inpatient, the law sufficiently now would cover those people that they're trying to get the net under. And even then, you cannot. There's no way. It's like saying, I have a needle in my house, now burn the whole house down, because, you know, you cannot. It's hard to predict who is going to be violent or not. But if, you know, if a person tells you they're going to hurt people and they have the means to do it, I say believe them. And I have to wrestle with the fact that that is saying that a person would get forced treatment. But like I said, if someone has the means, you know, you got four or five guns in your house, and you say you want to do that, I say believe the person. And and go from there. But assisted outpatient.
Right, but even then, but again, Yvonne, that is criminal. That is not psychiatric. That there would be a psychiatric response to a crime is the problem. And when they did know it, like with, what's his name, Elliot Rodger, where they show up to his house and they look and they leave.
They wouldn't be doing that. What you're saying is correct. I agree with you. They should arrest the person. In other words, if you say you got the means to do it and you say that you're going to hurt somebody and you should not be pussyfooting around with the mental health system, you say you've got 4 or 5 guns, you say you want to hurt somebody, you said it several times, just like Elliot said on the film, and if they had known that he had guns, then he should be arrested.
I mean, we're getting all over the place here, but I think that the important part is that the overwhelming majority of people who are subject to these things don't have guns, aren't in the process of hurting anybody, haven't done anything criminal, aren't in any way and a danger, quote unquote danger to society, and they are consistently positioned inside of this way that this is why we need to go do this because they're going to hurt somebody, and that is where the fraud comes in.
Well, it's a slippery slope. That's why it's best probably not to be all over the place, but get to the narrowness. The narrowness is why do people feel as though that they have to have this? And the reason why they feel that way, they don't feel that way. The reason why they put this out to the press is because of the guy in California, because of Columbine, because of the guy in Newtown. And the only thing I'm saying is that even no matter what kind of law they put, even if we had 3717 in place, it would not have affected any of those people.
No,
not at all. Just like.
Yeah, it's a veil, and then it's this money generating law that people who are subject to are, they're the only ones who aren't financially benefiting from this law are the people who are subjected to it, who are being tortured and forced drugged and having to have all of these other things happen to them, people showing up at your house or your job or, having to check in with somebody and tell them what you've been doing for the last week or whatever other ridiculous things, that these are not going to solve these mass murders, and that these aren't the people who are doing the mass murders or even the individual murders. If you look at, like, Kendra's Law, Andrew Goldstein, who pushed Kendra in front of the train after she snubbed him because he was trying to talk to her, and he, and I'm not justifying what he did, but he had sought help out dozens of times, and he would not qualify. Andrew Goldstein would not have qualified for Kendra's Law, and today would not qualify for Kendra's Law. If as it is written now, and it would not have stopped this heinous murder from happening.
Stop right there. This is the point. They're pushing all this judicial process, and I know you're going to have someone on your show to talk about that. They're pushing all this judicial process, but they don't have any service behind it. Just like my friend who I hope is listening, and they told me that they've been listening to the show because they called me and asked me yesterday what was going to be on the show. But, that they presented themselves. They needed help. The agency would help them. They presented themselves to the hospital because they were having a bad reaction to their medication. They know that they were off the hook, and they didn't do it. The same thing that you're talking about, the guy at Kendra's Law. He had asked for help, and he couldn't get it. So
Dozens of times. He was refused by the system literally dozens of times, and he would not qualify for the law because the law requires that you're refusing services. and he was trying to get help. And so this, again, it's this neoliberalism crap of where they are putting the focus of the problem on the individual instead of looking at the system. And the system is what is broken, and the system is what needs to be repaired. And the system, quite frankly, doesn't have answers for this, especially when you look at Columbine and all of these other, mass killings, the impact of the SSRIs. Nobody is paying attention, not nobody in terms of us, but nobody in power is paying attention to that. They don't want to pay attention to the fact that there are huge correlations between the SSRIs and the mass killings. There's a suicidality warning, a black box warning, a coffin warning on the SSRIs that they cause suicidality. One of the common factors of the mass murders is that the people wind up killing themselves. And so you need, as a society, we need to really be holding hearings on the SSRIs and looking at what are the actual root causes of this kind of violence. And unless you're
trying to get ahead of that, I posted something just today about that, came in the I think it was the Guardian, the United Kingdom, and they were saying since they had the black box warning claiming that more teenagers were dying of suicide. But the back story of the article was saying is that the physicians and people that were prescribing medication, they're getting more lazy. In other words, they have drunk the Kool-Aid that says we have a pill and we can give it to you. So therefore, people are getting medication, and they're not watching them. They're not doing. The reason why you go to an MD to get a prescription, whether we agree or not on the treatment is another matter, but you go because these all are very strong medications. They're very toxic. They have side effects, and the side effects, as you said, has to do with the SRIs. But the people are not monitoring them. They're not monitoring young people. These drugs were never meant for somebody who has an immature, and I don't mean that they're immature, but for their brain. And
no,
so
it's off-label prescribing. It's off-label prescribing if a young person is on SSRIs under 18. They're not supposed to be on them. The brain is still up until 25 at least. Developing, and then even some, and then even some that there's constant throughout life that we're always developing, and that
I took drugs 7 years. I was one of those people that was on drugs at 7 years of age. I was on drugs from 7 to the time that I was 21, and then off, and then not until I was in middle age. Then, so I know that these drugs do affect you, and they didn't have as many back then as they have now, so your choices weren't that great for you to have. So, yeah, then I'm in a school now, and I have a classmate that's in, I call it pod, the pod, and people are not able to function on these medications. They're not able to work because they have so many. You know, it never was intended that people have cocktails of 9 and 10 of these medications.
Yeah, 13, 14 drugs all at once, and then drugs to combat the side effects of the other drugs and so on and so forth. And, and then you wonder why people are, dying 25 to 30 years sooner than people who aren't on these drugs. And that psychiatry just does not have these answers. They do not have the answers for people, and it's very concerning.
I'll give the phone number again. It's 267-521-0167. If you want to call in, it's 267-521-0167. Maybe you know someone that has been on assisted outpatient treatment or been forcibly treated or yourself. Call in 267-521-0167. 6-7. And the thing about it, even though some people will say this, well, you know, they got the medication and maybe they changed because they got the medication, okay? Still, being forced to do anything does not mean that you will continue to do it. You know, it's like this. Good love making is a wonderful thing, but when it's forced, it's not.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and quite frankly, there are many people who call this psychiatric rape, and that, you know, that the idea that, you know, there's actual psychiatric physical rape that occurs by psychiatric workers or such, but also just the forced administration of a psychiatric drug into one's body can be seen as a type of rape. Area code 646, your line is open.
Oh, hey, it's Jake again. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Hello?
Yes,
pretty
hi.
Good. I, you know, as you know, I'm a neoliberal, so I got some neoliberal crap for you, which is I was listening to a conversation like 10 minutes back about the rise of enhanced or more efficient administration of neuroleptics like injectables and stuff. And I have a very simple answer to all of that is if you're subject to an outpatient order and someone shows up at your house, you're not home. You're never home. If they show up to your work, you go out and have a smoke. Or if someone accosts you, you say, you must have me confused with someone else. The reason why
like
I say
me.
All these things... Sorry?
You sound like me. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just like, you know, out there, like, who are you? Say, I'm Spartacus, or whatever. And the reason I say all this is it's not just that you can avoid administration of drugs you don't want to take. Is it the whole reason that outpatient orders became popular is because it's cheaper to show up to people's houses and try to twist their arm into taking the drug they want you to take, as opposed to locking you up and making you take it. Once you make it costly for them to make you take the drug that you don't want to take, they will eventually give up. And
well,
I wish
you were right, Jace, but unfortunately, they have state power behind them, and they will just send the police, and the police will then take you and institutionalize you. And so
I understand these points.
I would not advise people to play games with these folks. I don't know what to advise people to do, but I certainly it ups the ante when they have the state power to do anything.
I understand, and I was anticipating this. The thing is I'm actually looking into studies on this to see what you know to see if there's any information on enforcement. But you know, for example, in New York under Kendra's law, non-compliance with outpatient orders does not even rise to contempt of court. And there's a reason why it's structured that way. Is it so that it is that if it was subject to the full power of a court order, it would be subject to constitutional scrutiny, that they would have to show that they have a reason to infringe on your fundamental liberties. Therefore, it's I understand, and I also understand the state has these powers. But my point is that considering outpatient commitment is designed to make you comply at no cost to the state, once you start imposing costs, what happens? You are correct that this could eventually lead you to get taken to court. It could eventually lead you to get pulled in for a 72-hour observation and all that. But if the primary thing is you do not want to take the drugs that you've been forced to take for years, that's not necessary. That's just pulling up what's already happening anyways. And
well,
I understand also you say I don't advise that, but then you also say in the same breath you don't know what else to advise in the alternative.
I do. My advice is this. I shouldn't say advice. I said this is what worked for me.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, I'm not giving advice. I mean, I guess that's part of that. But
yeah,
to me, it seems like a dangerous game to intimidate somebody and tell them that you're Spartacus. I think that kind of thing will just give them more fuel as to why you need to be committed. I don't think that
is have more control in your life. For me, something I call wellness recovery action plan worked well for me, where I kept control of my life. I haven't been hospitalized since 1994. And I say I have crises, one or two a year, and I'm able to handle that because of my RAP plan. I use my RAP for it, and I try to stay out of the public mental health system. If you feel like you have to have a psychiatrist, if you can, I know we had discussions on this line, you have to try to do something else.
I think this point
from under the radar screen of the criminal justice psychiatric system altogether.
But Yvonne, I think this point that Jace is bringing up about the non-constitutionality of Kendra's law is really important and something that we should focus on for a minute. Because despite the fact that they can do all of this to you and that you don't want to give them any extra ammunition for how. Why you should be wind up involuntarily committed, and that the outpatient commitment isn't enough, and that you need to be institutionalized. So you want to be really careful around those kinds of things. The idea that Kendra's law in itself, Jace, is unconstitutional is really important. And so, what was this other thing that you were talking about? Is that it doesn't even meet a what?
Sorry,
Jace, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Yeah, so hi. So I'm just looking at this issue that it's unconstitutional as a law, but you had said something about it doesn't even meet a some standard of law.
Oh, well, here's the thing. Is it the way that they and it's been held by whatever we think about what the Constitution means, the Court of Appeals has upheld the constitutionality of the law. And one of the main ways in which they've done it is that when you violate someone's fundamental liberties, like hold them against their will or force them to take drugs, it has to satisfy a certain constitutional standard called strict scrutiny. And the way that they avoid it is they say the outpatient order to medicate is not violating your fundamental liberties not to be forced to take drugs, because you can ignore that order and it will not lead to contempt of court. What it will lead to, and this is what you're pointing out, is they will bring you in on a 72-hour hold and then take you to court. Now, this is you know, my liberal crap speaking, but my point is that if you want to evade authorities and just say, I'm not going to comply with this, ultimately, if you feel that things are going to being held or being subject to inpatient, the short answer is stop collecting all benefits from the system and move to another state.
Yeah,
I know that
except things
radical.
Like the Murphy. Except things like the Murphy bill. If Murphy passes, if H.R. 3717 passes, there will be a national database connecting state to state. Because like now, the last go around with Kendra's law, they eliminated, because you used to be able to just leave the county, and now they've eliminated that and they're tracking us county to county, but the H.R. 3717 will create the national database of where, with electronic medical records, if this is in your record, then anything going over. But I do think that people getting out of the state system is one definite way to help get yourself out of this thing, but that it's not only people who are subject. In other words, there are people on private insurance who are subjected to this also. It's not only people who are in the state system, although it definitely disproportionately affects people of color and people who are economically struggling. There are people in private insurance who are forced to comply. And then there's that question of where it really does become how much of this is financial incentive for these people to continually court order folks, because they're getting thousands of dollars on each time that the person has to get a shot or a drug or whatever, you know, every time a week.
But the truth is,
I take your point, because my point is that actually when you're privately insured, that's better from the psychiatric institution's perspective, because it's not subject to Medicaid caps. and that kind of thing, that you have a deeper pocket. But my only point is,
insurance doesn't want to deal with force. I can tell you this.
I can tell you that there's a person who calls in on this show regularly who's got private insurance, who is under Kendra's law on private insurance. And so that is a reality. They may not want to deal with it, but it is a reality of what is happening to at least some people.
Well, that's why I want to watch New York, because I don't want it to happen here, because here, where I am, private hospitals, unless they have contract beds, they do not want to deal with force. I know of a case now where a hospital desperately wants to help somebody to keep them there because they would get better treatment than going to the state hospital. But because the person has developmental disabilities and they're an older person, there's nobody to sign for them. So it might be the choice wherein they're going to have to go to the state hospital, where the private hospital, they would only keep them for a short time, where they would get housing. It cannot.
Hello?
Yeah, sorry. That's I've been trying to hit the mute button. But I hear you. I mean, my only point is that if you're going in for welfare benefits or to see a social worker, they will be hooked in with the mental health system. And when you go in for other kinds of assistance, they will immediately hook up and say, "Well, have you been complying with your outpatient order?" If you're on private insurance and you go to your dentist for a toothache, he will not care. And you know, regarding Murphy, I take your point, but you know, is it? I cannot even, you know, when I go to Utah, my New York traffic tickets don't even catch up to me. The fact that a system may be in place is whether that system actually works
right.
In terms of interstate cooperation is a practical question.
Murphy's Law, 3717 is put into effect, then everybody will be just like New York. That's the reason why other people that live elsewhere should care, because you might be in an area where you can right now be under the radar screen, but it will create national database where they will know who everybody is. They'll know everybody's a diagnostic history. Everybody will be coded.
Already, under the Thompson bill that just passed at the end of last month, they've already souped up that system to – they put millions of dollars more in to start keeping mental health records in the NCIS database. And so, I mean, the electronic record risk is definitely a huge piece of it, of the problem, for people being able to escape it. But I think that this idea of the unconstitutionality of it, and that you're not held in contempt of court, you might wind up being institutionalized, but you're not held in contempt of court for this, I think is an important point for people to realize in trying to figure out how to adequately fight this if you're subjected to it.
And you can be there for a long time. You can be there for a long time. I know someone now. I just saw him last week. I've known him for a considerable amount of time. He was part of a protest at one of the local TV stations. And I can't remember what year it was, but it's been at least 2 decades. In essence, he's really a political prisoner. He does not even take medication. He's at the state hospital. So you could be there for a long time, because if they say that you are psychiatrically compromised, then it's between the psychiatrist and the judge of when they let you go.
Yes. As you point out, he is institutionalized, and if I'm understanding you correctly, he's not taking meds either. Is that right?
I have to ask him. I don't know if they ever even prescribed medicine for him. But see, this is according to him, that he's a political prisoner. I know that sometime in the past he talked to David Oakes or whatever, and I was trying to see about getting a lawyer or something to see about getting him out, because usually a lot of these NGRI cases where we are, and you can look it up. I'd like to send Lauren a link on this. The average, they stay very long, 20, 30 years. I mean, we had someone who got out because they stole a necklace and they finally got out after 30 years or something. Although most of the real long-term cases are capital cases, but there are people where they have little petty things. Or I know of people where they've been used as a nursing home, you know. They were dropped off there, and they've been there for a long time, 30, 40 years. I know a husband and wife couple. I know the husband. He was born in the state hospital. But, you know, you can't stay there for a long time. It varies from state to state. And if what happens in New York becomes standard practice, if that's looked at as a model,
well, I mean, it's H.R. 3717 that we have to worry about. That, I mean, that's what's going to make this a national issue, because it mandates this, and then it mandates the electronic medical records and the tracking of people from place to place. And I think that becomes a definite concern for people. And how do you then create a landing zone for somebody safely to be able to get out of something and redevelop their life when the medical records are right there and everything is electronic and that it extends from one to the next?
And we used to think they had everything, but that's the way it's going. Yeah. So.
Hey, Lauren, I understand your aversion to giving advice or appearing to give advice on a public broadcast. I have a piece of sort of punk rock advice that I have seen people act on that works. Can I email it to you?
Sure.
Yeah, I will email it to you. You decide what to do with it.
Okay.
Well, you can tell us whether you use.
You can
it
say
yourself.
Whatever
that's
you want.
Okay. That's
I'll say. And again, this is just practical advice. Mm-hmm. I've known many people who've committed. You know, and it is a commitment to drug rehab by their parents, much along the lines of that suicidal tendency song that I sent to you.
Yeah.
And who are stuck there because they don't think they have a problem. They just, you know, do what they do. The way that you get kicked out of a lot of institutions is use and transact recreational drugs within the institution. They will immediately throw you out.
Oh, no, they won't do that here.
It's not in a psychiatric institution. If you're in a drug rehab or if it's a substance use, and that's a violation of the terms of your being there and all that kind of stuff, yeah, sure. But in a psychiatric facility,
they won't even kick people out for smoking. Now we got a real issue about people wanting to have sexual age. But no, that won't work there. That won't work at all. What I advise people is anybody who has had a lot of touching with the system is to have a lawyer on call at all times. Become familiar with it. You had a public defender before, become familiar with the public defender's office, if that's the only choice that you have. Develop pro bono attorneys that you know of, or whatever else, and carry their cards with you. And there's nothing like having to call someone up and have lawyer so-and-so's office to call back, even if it's the paralegal. So that's what I advise is to, and also become familiar with your P&A. Is to, you should have a little, in your little wallet or purse or whatever, have two or three cards. Yeah. And, you know, that is probably the best thing to do because people don't like when other people are involved.
Yeah,
I have considered this.
Okay.
And go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jay. Sorry.
No, I said I have considered this, and although I'm not qualified to practice law in this area, I hand out my cards to my friends because when cops talk to them, they immediately want to stop talking to them when they see my card.
That's right. It works. You should have several of them, though, because you need all that stuff for backup. Because especially if you are poor and you don't have any money, the more when they see you, they use the term lawyered up. That's what you have to do. You have to develop those kind of relationships. If you don't have money, if you're poor, you have to develop that early on.
Yeah, the only problem is, though, The only problem with that, and I don't dispute that as good practice, and I think that people should have good relationships with lawyers just in case. But if you're coming in on a psychiatric, if you're getting called and you're getting, you know, hauled off to a psychiatric institution, it's not like a jail where you get a phone call. You don't get
a phone
call.
Someone who's familiar with that type of proceeding. You just don't go out and get anybody. I mean, his friends, that probably worked because of whatever it was. You have to have someone who's familiar with that proceeding and what is happening.
No, but I'm saying that people think that when they get picked up and institutionalized that they're going to be able to get a phone call. You don't get a phone call. You don't get a phone call until you've behaved well enough for X amount of time that you can earn a phone call.
I get calls all the time like that. I get calls all the time. I'm on the cell phone. Yvonne, I don't know if I'm in a paddy wagon or in a car. They're taking me to CPAP. I get calls like that all the time.
Well, if somebody has a cell phone, but if you're on a psychiatric institute, when you get institutionalized, one of the first things they do is take away your phone and your phone privileges.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have the right to make a phone call. You don't have the right to tell people, you know, where you are or what's going on or any of that. Perhaps while you're being transported over there, yeah. But when you're going through the institutionalization process, you have to put all of your belongings into a little plastic box, and you don't get them back until you leave. And so people aren't allowed to have cell phones, for example, in institutions, at least in New York, for the most part that I'm aware of.
I've had people call me. I don't know where I am, and I say, what's around you, whatever else. And they're in either a contract bed or they're in the state hospital. So
let me ask you a different, Lauren, two questions to what you were saying. I understand that you don't have an immediate right to talk to anyone, but eventually they have to let you talk to your mommy, I take it, when you say, I want my mommy. At some point, you get to talk to your mommy. Is that an accurate statement of after 72 hours?
I'm not exactly sure as to what the process is, but for most times, the communication, I don't want to put this out the wrong way, but you generally have to earn privileges for communication. I'm not sure. I'm trying to find the OMH policy directly as to what it is, but it definitely is an issue for people being able to, like, have their own cell phones, be able to determine how much amount of time that they're on the phone. I believe there are pay phones in the majority of institutions. And so once you can get to that point of being able to, make a phone call,
What I'm saying is, more practically speaking, I've read firsthand accounts of this. At some point, and I'm leading to another question after this, another rhetorical question, actually, is that at some point you are allowed to have your friends and family visit. And it's not written in any policy, but the idea of I want to talk to my mommy, at some point, whether or not you are you've accepted the diagnosis or behave properly, they have to let you talk to your mommy. And I've seen this played out, and I've talked to people who have been involuntarily committed, and they have to let you do that at least after the 72-hour hold. The point that this gets to is whenever, and by mommy I mean friend or family or person that you trust. It's important for that person to have a card of, sorry, ma'am, what's your name?
Yvonne.
Jake. Mm-hmm. Is it, like, at some point, that person has to have cards of people that they can go to have professional credibility. And that is not only an attorney who can eventually get you to a hearing, that is also a mental health professional who can help, counter and mitigate the diagnosis. And, you know, I know this I mean, give me some credit for my thinking, because I have never been in this situation, and part of the reason I've never been in this situation is I have avoided these situations with these techniques. I carry two cards in my wallet. Two cards in my wallet. One is my lawyer, and the other is my aunt, who is not who is an MD who reviews psychiatric records in Utah, who is not qualified to practice as a psychiatrist, but supervises and evaluates psychiatric diagnoses. So whenever I've had any trouble, I would be like, I would like to talk to my aunt, please, who also works with the public health department in Utah. And these things help to, I don't know what it does for you once you've been in, because I've never been in, but I have deterred anyone trying to take me in by saying, I guess, you know, Yvonne, as you put it, I'm lawyered up. And it's also, as we also may put it, I'm shrinked up. Because when you go to a hearing, this is also cited as a defect with Kendra's law, is that you have a right to a public defender. That public defender is never funded to have an expert to evaluate the committing expert's diagnosis. As soon as you may have that other person, or even lead people to think you may have that person who can provide an independent evaluation of that diagnosis, it makes it more trouble than it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I'm just looking at the OMH rights policy. It says that you have a reasonable a right to a reasonable telephone use and visitors. You will have reasonable access to a telephone. But, you know, determining what reasonable is unclear, and I know that in some places that was part of the point system, so you needed to earn a certain level before you were allowed to communicate with people freely.
I know. Where I am, we had substantial lawsuits and stuff in fact because of extreme abuse over the decades. So people do, you know, most people now have a cell phone. And I always say, you know, call while mobile crisis is transporting you. Let someone know where you are, because you don't know. When you get there, you know, if you're in a, for example, most hospitals, the nurses run the show. So if they want to say you can't have something, you can't have it. But usually people do, because at least in the District of Columbia, they have to let you have phone calls. They have to have you to call out. You have relatives that live long distance. You have to be able to make the long distance call. They have to give you paper and stamps to be able to communicate. So, like, you know, it varies from state to state, but we had a lot of extreme abuse. We had a law case called, we call it a Dixon law case, and we were sort of like kind of on probation getting out of a Department of Justice order. But, yeah, people can do that. We had open-ended outpatient commitment. That's why I feel so passionate about it. Because up until about 10 years ago, people were on outpatient commitment. They were open-ended. That meant for the rest of their life. It's not that true They can review every year. They can review the outpatient commitment. They have something else called convalescent leave. There are many people who are in the state hospital, and they're out. Maybe they've been out for years, but they're still maybe carrying on roles in the state hospital. That's so that they can yank them back at any time. So there's all kinds of ways that you could take people's liberty away. That's why I want to make sure that we look at 3717 very strongly, but it might be a red herring, because all this stuff is individuals and states, and the good thing about Murphy of striking it down is you want to strike it down early, so some of these more draconian things are not there. But I do agree with the other caller that having these other contacts, because when you are picked up, you might not be at your best. You might not be able to think very clearly. So it's very good to have people that you can contact. And the first person you contact should be someone like what I have been called behind my back is a dog. It would tell people, you call your dogs out on me. So you want to call the person also who feels very passionate about it, and they will. If they're the only person that you call, that they know who else to call to marshal, so that you can be more trouble than you're worth, and that they want to get you out as quickly as possible.
here's when you point out, I was going to say, you know, you may not be at your best, which is a good way of putting it, because I hate these things like, you know, may not be in your right mind, because that, again, you know, sort of validates the idea of mental illness. The usual term is like, I'm just having a freak out or a bad hair day or whatever. And the question, to keep it simple for when you're not at your best, the one question you ask when you want contact with the outside world is saying, who can I call to tell them I'm here?
When you go to the emergency room, you do the same thing. You don't go to the emergency room by yourself. You have other people meet or call you. And other people know that you're other supporters, other people that are being there for you. You don't do that alone. There's no such thing. You're not in a prison where you get one phone call.
I think Jason's point about who can I call, as the way that you approach staff in trying to get a phone call, is not like I need to call somebody to be get out of here, but who can I call to let them know that I'm here, is the subtlety, I think, of the way that the conversation can get directed differently.
Exactly. Once they come,
if there's resistance on that, and this is just, it's not real lawyering, it's just practical advice, is whether it's true or not, if there's resistance, just say, I got to get someone to pick up my kids from school. I have an obligation that I have to meet that I cannot meet because I am here. Who do I tell to tell that other person to get my kids from school?
You usually don't have to go into all that.
Fair enough, but the point is that they want to hold you because if they're in good faith about it, they're worried that if they let you go, you're going to go do harm to yourself or others. If you point out that them holding you may result in harm falling to others who cannot help themselves, they will be thinking lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, when people go to that, because when I go to, like, CPAP for someone, what they try to do is also, because I'm not a licensed professional or anything like that, or my organization don't have that insurance, they want to, let's say, we'll release the person with you. I says no. I don't allow them to release them with you. They have to release them by themselves. Usually what happens, they'll release them a few hours, you know, later after I leave. The CPAP is, I don't know what they have for in New York or whatever state you're in. It's like a central clearing place. So when mobile crisis picks somebody up, they take them to a place, and this is usually a place they can't keep them for 72 hours. They have maybe a bed or two or whatever else. They decide whether that person is, what hospital they're going to go to. Because in the District of Columbia, you don't automatically go to the state hospital. They'll send you to a private hospital, private bed. We've done that for several years because they can check the person out. Maybe there's some physical reason why some things are going on or whatever, and that allows them to do testing or whatever. But they usually keep the person there for a few hours. A lot of people get released. And they keep coming back there, and they end up being hospitalized anyway. But they don't keep a person from making phone calls. And the police are usually the people that bring them, or the mobile crisis unit that brings them to this little kind of triage type of place.
Well, I think that there's, you know, so many things that people need to be concerned about in the process of when they're being, if they're being picked up for involuntary treatment, of the best ways to go about doing things, and for people to remember that they see as evidence of any of this psychiatric stuff existing, you denying it. And so every time you say no to them, it's an explanation and proof of the fact that this quote-unquote psychiatric condition exists. And so, in a weird kind of way, one of the, you know, ways of getting around this sometimes is saying, you know, yeah, I know that this is going to sound a little off, and I'd really like some help. And then they'll tell you no, because you have too much insight into your condition, therefore you can't be mad And so, but that
really?
that people really need to understand that every time you deny what it is that they're saying, they see that as evidence for it existing.
No, for reals? Does that work?
Well,
being overly intelligent on the things that they want to talk to you about, do they just back off?
Does it work? Does it work? I don't know, but we can show for sure that people who are asking for services and who are asking for medication and who are asking for help are refused, and the people who are saying that they don't want it and they don't need it and that there's nothing wrong are forced. And so, you know, does it work? I don't know. But I know that if they say, well, you're depressed, and you say, well, no, I'm not, they say, well, that's evidence that you are. And so that gives us the right
I understand the agnosia dynamic, which is that if you deny it, then it confirms a diagnosis. And again, my experience is more with dealing with cops than psychiatric professionals. And my usual response is not to confirm or deny anything, but just to say, advise me, please, what questions I have to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and with cops, that always makes you back off because you have a right against self-incrimination. With shrinks, I don't really know. But the idea, it's like, I understand that if you resist a diagnosis, if you play along, resist a diagnosis, then that's agnosia. But if you just say, do I have to talk to you? Is that, I understand that that is not going to be taken well, as opposed to cooperating and say, yes, I have a problem.
Good guy. The thing. See, the thing about it, we're playing, we shouldn't be playing with this because these are very serious things. And there's a different situation when you go to a CPAP, like I described, or when you go before a judge. And the psychiatrist is there, and they're just validating whatever. These are very different situations. And Lauren is right. That's what happens if people deny, that's just deeper. The only one time that I was on a drug panel, they only let me be on there one time, and then they had no use for me. When I had, there was a young lady, she was pregnant. She was in our equivalent state hospital. And our regulations in the District of Columbia say that when you don't want to take medication, that they have to have two physicians and an advocate present to say that you would do it. And they asked me to go over, come over from the authority to sit on this panel. And, of course, I said she didn't need to take the medication because she was pregnant. She didn't want to take the medication. They acted as if she had reacted in a certain way. What happened, she was in the elevator, so it bumped up against her stomach, and she put her hands up. So they used that as a reason to try to say that she needed to have medication. So we can't play back and forth with this because what happens is every situation is different, but it is a good idea to have to call as soon as you can. Supporters, don't wait. If you got a cell phone, to call people and to talk to your lawyer about whatever's going on. We just hope that we can't hope. We have to be activated and make sure that the sunset of Kendra's Law, things like H.R. 3717, that they don't come a pass because everybody's not going to have the wherewithal or be in a good place to do all these little strategies that we know can work for them, and sometimes they don't. But they will not mean nothing if H.R. 3717 comes into place because they'll have a system in place where they will just march people into assisted outpatient treatment. There will not be any recourse for people, because the decks will be stacked up against them. I think that is the way I see it anyway.
Well, it's not only outpatient treatment. It's also back to institutions with H.R. 3717, and we can't forget that. There's a goal to expand institutionalized beds in institutions to create, to make it easier for your privacy rights to be, battened down on by allowing parents to have access to your medical records as an adult child of somebody that your parent is then called in on these things and given,
and it's a slippery slope
insight into your public records.
Your employer might have to know this information. So, you know, it's a slippery slope. You know, it's a slippery slope. Once you're an adult and you have adult individuals getting your records, these are your parents. You're over 18, over 21. You have no duty. So what's to say later on? They say that your employer has the right to know about your history. You know, it's a slippery slope. We have to stick to tracks.
Yeah, and I think that we will be continuing conversations on this and other hot topics of the day as they relate to the psychiatric system. I want to thank everybody who called in tonight and who's been listening in. I encourage you to call in the future. Again, on June 26th, we will be having a special show with Dr. Bonnie Burstow, and on July 9th, there will be a special on judicial accountability and the jury trial. If you have a tip, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line at area code 718-273-8708. 718-273-8708. Thanks, everybody. Keep on talking. Until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon.